Hello and welcome to Eye on the Middle East, a weekly podcast produced by NeonTommy.com at USC Annenberg Digital News. I am your host, Benjamin Gottlieb.
And I am your co-host, Arzu Rezvani. On today's program, the ongoing demonstrations in Tunisia, Algeria, and now Egypt, the six-power nuclear talks with Iran, and Al Jazeera's recent release of the Palestine Papers.
Our expert guest today is Philip Sieb, director of the USC Center on Public Diplomacy. We would like to remind our listeners that Eye on the Middle East can be found on iTunes and online at NeonTommy.com. So Arzu, I'm sure you've been following the enduring unrest in Northern Africa. With continuing demonstrations in Tunisia, thousands took to the street in Cairo early this week to protest against political repression and unemployment under President Hosni Mubarak, who has ruled the country for 3 decades. A number of fresh protests were planned throughout Cairo for Wednesday morning, but they fizzled amid warnings from Egypt's interior ministry that it would crack down on the demonstrations if they took to the streets. With the protests we see unfolding in the region, what can you say about the possibility of an extremist regime, such as the Muslim Brotherhood, for example, coming into power?
Well, Islamist groups in that region seem to be more organized because they have places where they can organize. Generally speaking, in countries that limit the freedom of speech and stifle political expression, it's difficult for parties who challenge these limitations to effectively gather and organize. Now, that said, right now, you see the head of the Islamist party in Tunisia making a lot more noise than usual. And this is to be closely followed because, as history has shown, and let us take the 1979 Iranian Revolution, for example, people tend to think that anything is better than the status quo, and that can lead and has led to poorly informed decisions. As Tunisia moves forward with protests and the Ben Ali regime dissolves, it really behooves the Tunisians to question any party, group, or individual who claims that they are fit to assume leadership.
So, Arzu, something interesting that happened to me today. I spoke with a friend of mine who is a journalist in Cairo. His name is Amr Ramadan. And he told me that he doesn't see the protests amounting to anything. And he also sees no clear leader to step in after Mubarak.
Well, it's really tough to say. I mean, protests start for different reasons, right? So typically it's because of economic reasons, the disparity in wealth distribution, for example, accessibility to education. Will they fizzle? That really depends on the support the government has. Do the police forces support the government, or do they side with the people? I just want to add that I think that the Arab world needs to take a long and hard look at whether they provide opportunities for their people, from economic opportunities to education, because in the end, this is really what it's all about, disparity between those who have and those who have nothing or feel that they have nothing. Mohamed Bouzazi felt stuck, and I would argue that there are thousands of others in the Arab world who feel the same way and have finally been moved to demand more from their governments.
So let's move now to Iran. Once again, Iran's nuclear program is in the limelight. Diplomats from the 5 permanent members of the UN Security Council, including Germany, were in Istanbul for talks last week with Iran's chief nuclear negotiator. Now, Arzu, can you flesh out an argument? I seem to hear a lot from the Iranians that if Iran's neighbors have nuclear weapons, then Iran should also have the right to develop their own nuclear weapons. Do you think this is a valid point?
Okay, well, assuming the Iranians are developing nuclear arms, I think the West can do a better job to understand why Iran feels the need to develop such arms. It is a country surrounded by U.S. military bases, I think 13, if I'm not mistaken, and India, Pakistan, Israel, all of whom have nuclear weapons outside the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, haven't had to pay a price. In fact, Pakistan has received nearly $20 billion in the last decade from the U.S. Pakistan, whose nuclear program, I would argue, is tremendously insecure. So for those who argue that Iran also deserves the right to enrich uranium and build a nuclear program, I see the point.
But isn't the goal of the international community to encourage non-proliferation amongst nations of the world?
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with that. I'm adamant about my belief that Iran should not be developing nuclear weapons. And that's simply because we can't abide by the proliferation of nuclear arms anywhere, and especially in the Middle East. Now, this isn't because I think Iran is an irrational actor, that President Ahmadinejad is irrational, or that Iran will use those weapons on Israel. They're very well aware of the mutually assured destruction that would ensue. and they're very well aware of Israel's second strike capability. But to have nuclear weapons build up in that region, a region that is unstable, a region that is still trying to grapple with extremism, I just don't think that endorsing nuclear proliferation for any country in that area makes much sense. All right, Ben, a major development caught my attention over the weekend, the Palestine Papers. The biggest document leak in the history of the Middle East conflict made headlines Sunday when international news network Al Jazeera released 1,600 confidential documents, including meeting minutes, emails, and secret proposals. The documents cover the period from the run-up to the Camp David negotiations under U.S. President Bill Clinton in 2000 to private discussions last year involving senior officials and politicians in the Obama administration.
Now, among the documents are notes handwritten in Arabic revealing an exchange in 2005 between the PA and Israel on a plan to kill a Palestinian fighter by the name of Hassan al-Madhoun. Al-Madhoun, who lived in the Gaza Strip, was leading a movement aligned to Fatah, which at that stage still held power in Gaza. And I think this leak in particular is significant because it shows that the PA was willing to deal with the Israelis to essentially kill one of their own.
So are these developments worse for the Palestinians or the Israelis?
You know, personally, I think these developments are worse for the Palestinians. With the Israelis, it kind of shows what we already know, that they're rigid, that they will go to the negotiating tables, but that they won't necessarily give up on a few points. I think if you pore over the leaks, which you can find on Al Jazeera titled The Palestine Papers, you'll see that the Palestinians were serious about negotiations, even to the point where they would compromise the best interests of their people. We want to take a quick break to remind you that you are listening to Eye on the Middle East. I am your host, Benjamin Gottlieb.
And I am your co-host, Arzu Rezvani. Professor and USC Center on Public Diplomacy Director Philip Sieb joins us in the next segment on Al Jazeera's recent release of the Palestine Papers. Philip Sieb is a professor of journalism, public diplomacy, and international relations at the University of Southern California, and is also the director of the USC Center on Public Diplomacy. He has authored and edited numerous books, including New Media and the New Middle East, The Al Jazeera Effect, and Global Terrorism and New Media. He is editor of the Palgrave Macmillan Series in International Political Communication and co-editor of the journal Media, War, and Conflict. Professor Sieb, welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Philip, the first thing I think that we need to examine is, who does this look worse for, the PA, or is this worse for the Israeli government?
Well, I think the Palestinian Authority has really suffered the most, and I wouldn't be surprised if that was Al Jazeera's intent. Compared to Hamas, the Palestinian Authority in these papers looks kind of weak-kneed. Now, what long-term effect that will have, I'm not sure. There's really nothing, as with the big WikiLeaks dump, there's really nothing terribly surprising in these revelations, that politicians are doing deals behind people's backs. Well, big deal. I mean, that happens. And I doubt that anybody, especially the critics of the Palestinian Authority, will find much new here, except some fairly hard evidence. So it does shake things up in an already very delicate situation.
Wouldn't you argue that this might, in fact, shed light on the fact that the Israelis themselves are very rigid in these talks and have been so for a number of years?
Well, that's not a surprise either. I mean, everybody knows the Israelis have been quite inflexible for the most part in these talks. And when they offer a deal in one particular area, they get harder in another. The Israelis are very, very good negotiators in terms of protecting their interests. And that shouldn't be a surprise to anyone either. The Palestinian Authority, by comparison, looks somewhat amateurish.
If we could move to one particular leak, which one would you say is the most significant?
Well, probably the discussion involving Jerusalem and the apparent willingness of the Palestinian Authority to back off. Now, we're making the assumption also as we talk about this that all this information is accurate. There are all kinds of possibilities of disinformation in this kind of process too. But based on what we've seen, I think that the anger, which Hamas will certainly stir up toward the Palestinian Authority, will be largely based on what is perceived as being a willingness to give up on claims to parts of Jerusalem.
So why do you feel, or why do you think that the Palestine Papers haven't made bigger headline news in the United States?
Well, international news rarely makes big headline news in the United States. Even the events that have been going on in Egypt in the past couple of days haven't really done that. American media are fairly provincial. If, however, you look at Al Jazeera, both the Arabic and the English versions of Al Jazeera have made a huge deal about this, as have other media organizations in the region. And that's where the issue is most important, not in the U.S.
This new leak style of reporting or journalism, so to speak, do you think this is a trend we will continue to see on news sites around the globe?
Well, as you say, journalism, so to speak, is a good way to put it. I think that diplomats are going to have to recognize that that information that used to be kept confidential fairly easily is now much more likely to get to the public. Diplomacy and transparency don't always go very well together, but that's going to happen. That's going to be a necessary combination in the future. So, I think we will see these things. And there are so many venues online to distribute this kind of information. It's really irresistible to somebody who wants to, say, further a particular interest or sabotage another interest. You just put it online and then everybody starts picking it up.
If we could move to one of the leaks in particular that I found interesting, there was a senior Palestinian negotiator. He came to an agreement with the Israelis, so to speak, with regard to the right of return. He said that they would agree for 1,000 Palestinians outside of the country to be brought in for 10 years, amounting to 10,000. We all know that the Palestinian diaspora is closer to about 5 million. Do you think this concession is a slap in the face to people who want to return to their homes in Israel?
Well, anything at that scale is not a real right to return. It's just a gesture. And I think that's one of the reasons that Palestinian Authority is not particularly popular in some quarters of Palestine right now, because that is seen, again, as selling out. People don't want empty gestures. They want a right to return.
Now, I have one final question. As director of the Center on Public Diplomacy, what role do you think public diplomacy has played in the Arab-Israeli conflict, if any role at all?
Well, not a very good role, effective role anyway, because the conflict goes on endlessly. I think public diplomacy is important for both sides, because given the apparent intractability of both the Palestinians and the Israelis when they're negotiating with each other, they are both trying to reach out to a larger constituency, international constituency. And you can see it particularly most recently with the Palestinians making a push to get diplomatic recognition from other countries. And I think that in the battle of public diplomacy, I think the Palestinians in some ways have done better, or else I guess you could look at it that the Israelis have not done a very good job recently, because particularly if you look at opinion polls in Western Europe, you see that that Israel's popularity has dropped considerably during the last 15, 20 years, and the Palestinians, the issue of Palestinian rights has grown stronger in those same constituencies.
Professor Sieb, thanks for joining us today on the show.
You're very welcome.
This is Eye on the Middle East, broadcast live from the basement of the USC Annenberg Graduate School of Journalism. Please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Just search for Neon Tommy, Eye on the Middle East.
Thank you, and stay tuned for next week's podcast featuring Dr. Roxana Bahramitash. Take care.